through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Happy Friday. Jake, back in studio. How's it feel being back in the studio after being in a tiny West Coast market for
Yeah, it was hard being in San Diego. I felt like I was invisible. No one knew where I was.
Exactly. That's part of the problem.
So hard to be there. So I'm really glad to be back. Missed the fam. So I got to
Did you miss us?
Got to see the kiddos.
And then walked in
and got to see Curtis, which was a great part of my Friday. Okay. So
I love seeing you.
Yeah,
so
I mean, you saw
Brooke, the kids, Curtis, and
Kyle Brown, Curtis.
DJ Mora,
fam.
Paul.
Yeah, I mean, it was
everybody.
No one missing.
Pretty great start to the day. So, Stace, what do we got to talk about?
Neat. Well, we've been talking a lot about Mariners starting spring training. Pitchers and catchers reported earlier this week. We've been talking about Russell Wilson, everything that's happening with that, not just because it's an interesting conversation, but obviously because it is the quarterback of your football team that is talking about the team. I mean, it's wild. It's been a crazy story. But the other day, Wyman and Bob, the show that follows us, obviously, and also friends of the show, were talking about the Seahawks defense. And they were saying all this talk about Russell Wilson has caused us to overlook a lot of questions, whether it be things that you're excited about, like, say, the development of Jordan Brooks, who Wyman was very partial to, whether it be guys that we're overlooking, like an extension for Jamal Adams, maybe the Seahawks' number one priority this offseason. Maybe it's the excitement you have about their midseason turnaround, or maybe it's questions you have about whether that turnaround is legitimate and will continue to start the season. Either way, a lot of questions, a lot of conversation about the Seahawks defense has been overlooked, frankly. And, you know, it kind of makes sense. The Seahawks parted ways with Brian Schottenheimer, which dominated a ton of headlines. We talked about the Super Bowl and conversations about franchise quarterbacks leading into that. But Bob Stelton said something interesting the other day. In cut number one, he pointed out what he felt was a difference in the way we were talking about the offense versus the defense last year.
They allowed a backup with one game of experience to drive the field on him. They allowed a guy without a thumb who couldn't throw a spiral to have his way with them at points and complete, you know, these passes down the field you'd otherwise think were impossible. So, you know, it's just interesting that the defense, as much as it's been a year-in, year-out problem in recent years, nothing's really changing there in terms of who's in charge or what they're going to do about it. Yet there was a sense of urgency to really address what was going on with the offense.
Now, the Seahawks defense is in a bit of an interesting spot. You have some superstar players on there. Bobby Wagner, he's not going anywhere. KJ Wright, will he be back in 2021? You've got to figure out what to do with Jamal Adams and Carlos Dunlap. Carlos Dunlap entering the final year of his deal with a completely non-guaranteed salary. So you've got some big decisions to make. That's the first part. The second part is you've got both a defense that took a massive step forward and a defense that also carries a ton of question marks into 2021, Jake. The Seattle Seahawks defense finished with 46 sacks. That was after having just nine sacks by the bye week. And that came the year after they finished with, I think, 29. They might have been 30 or 31st in the league total in sacks last year. Well, they turned that around and were top 10 in sacks this year. They finished with 109 quarterback hits. That was also up from 2019. They finished with 14 interceptions. And really the most impressive part is the yards per game. They were on a pace to shatter the Saints defense 2011 record for most yards per game. And they turned that around, finished 22nd in the league in yards allowed. That doesn't sound especially impressive on its face, but consider that they were on pace to allow more than 7,000 in a single season. Ended up bringing that total down, which at its worst was 472 yards per game to 380. All of this is great. They still finished 31st in pass yards allowed. Not fantastic. They got to figure out what to do with Shaquille Griffin. Got a couple free agents. Yada, yada, yada. Look, we all know the deal. The Seahawks defense at one point in 2013 was not just the best defense in the league, but one of the best defenses in NFL history.
Mm-hmm.
Now we got to do a temperature check and figure out not just where they are now, but where they can be in 2021, Jake.
The big questions that I have in regards to this defense is, are they going to was the progress made legitimate at the end of the season? Well, they were on a staggering change in terms of where they were. I mean, you talk about the sacks. That was incredible, led by Carlos Dunlap, in my opinion, which made everybody else better around him. And that 46 sacks was a remarkable number after what you just said about the bye week. Very real, very legitimate, and very encouraging. Last five games of the season, only giving up 13.6 points per game. Only 189.7 passing yards per game. Only allowing 6 passing touchdowns per game after they struggled so much in that area for a huge chunk of the year. Now, I look at that and I believe that there was legitimate progress that was made. And as a defense, it doesn't matter really the opponent that you're playing, Stacey. It matters how you're playing together and are you improving together. And they were one of the worst defenses in the league and dramatically improved. And their numbers, the last five games of the season, said that they were a top five defense in the league and being number one in a lot of categories. The caveat to that, though, is that I don't believe moving forward that you can say that this defense has everything that it needs to be a top five defense in 2021. I think you're crazy if you say that. If you say this team, the Seattle Seahawks defense, is going to be a top five defense in 2021, I can't get there with you. Because the other reality is that the offenses that they were playing at the time to finish those last five games of the season were also one of the league's worst. You played the Jets, who were 32nd in the league in total offense. The Eagles, who were 25th. The Giants, who were 31st. Washington, who was 30th. And the Rams and the 49ers at the time in the last five games of the year were not playing their best football offensively. So although I believe that that turnaround was legitimate and a huge step in the right direction, I don't think it led them to being a top five defense that was going to be like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Stacey, where they made play after play after play that got them to the Super Bowl and ultimately helped them dominantly win the Super Bowl against the Kansas City Chiefs. I think that they turned themselves into a defense. This is very important. They turned themselves into a defense that could play legitimately good complementary football and a defense that could hold its own and make plays, but they were not going to be the defense that was going to win you those games when it came playoff time. And I don't think that you should expect this defense to do that for you moving forward. I think that's unfair. I think it's fair for you to expect better results heading into 2021, but this will not be a top five dominant defense, and I think that's an important factor. I think they'll be a good defense, but not a flat out dominant one like they were the last five games of the year.
And you know, I think we get into these weird places where we both create fake choices. Like, you don't have to choose to be only an offensive team or only a defensive team. You don't have to choose that. But in order to be really strong on both sides of the ball, you need to have made great draft choices and great salary cap decisions, because the league is set up for parity. So when I was writing this down, I wrote down the question, your team, meaning let's say you all are Seattle Seahawks fans, your team, the Seattle Seahawks, will only go as far as your blank can carry you. If the answer is defense, what do you need? If the answer is offense, what do you need? Now, most fans are going to hear that and understandably say, well, why not both? Well, the answer is, when I think of a team immediately that was strong on both sides of the ball, easy answer, Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Mm-hmm. Won Super Bowl 55 because they had a great offense and also a great defense, strengthened by a great defensive line, defensive front seven, but were pretty great in most areas of the ball on both sides of the ball. Well, they haven't made the playoffs since 2007, had some really nice draft picks, hit on a lot of those picks, including the number five pick overall with Devin White, currently the best linebacker in the year, played like the best linebacker in the year last year. They also had some high draft picks, getting a guy like wide receiver Mike Evans in there. Oh, not to mention they had money to throw around and bring in Tom Brady. So it is true that you can be good at both sides of the ball, but you have to have hit on a lot of draft picks and have guys on rookie deals to make that work. Seattle's not in that spot right now. It is a product of their success, but it also means that sometimes you need to lean into one side of the ball.
Well,
It does, and I think that that's the reason why ultimately I'm making this statement about the defense is because I believe that this group can be significantly better. I mean, I hope all are hoping that this defense will be better than what they started out with in 2020. I mean, it's not hard to improve upon that performance at the beginning of the year. And that's why I think with this defense, they've got a lot of good pieces in place. Puna Ford, Jaron Reed in the middle. If you're able to restructure or extend Carlos Dunlap for a more manageable cap hit, he's a big factor. And then you add all the other rotational pieces on your defensive line. Hopefully Daryl Taylor comes back and is able to play well in his first season of real action. They've got really high hopes for him. I think the linebacking core stays in place. They re-sign KJ Wright. You got Bobby Wagner, Jordan Brooks, and KJ Wright. You've got Jamal Adams, Quandre Diggs. The corners are a little bit of a question, but you know that DJ Reed's going to be there. You know who's going to be your guys, right? And there's areas to improve. But I believe that that group is set up to a point where they don't have a tremendous amount of depth. They don't have the depth that is required to be a truly dominant defense. When you look at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers and you look at their front four, yes, they were very good. But the guys that were rotating in as well were very, very good. And so I ultimately look at the way the Seahawks defense ended the year. I think that they were good. They weren't elite. They were not an elite defense at the end of the year. And one of the things that I look at and hold a strong opinion towards or great reverence towards their opinion is Dave Wyman. And Dave Wyman, over everything else that you could be mad about, the way that that game ended with the Rams in the wild card, Dave Wyman actually came in here angry about the defense. Because he, in his opinion, the defense, we knew what their job was supposed to be. To come out and repeat that same defensive performance that they had versus the Rams last time, versus a offense Hobbled. That was struggling to find their struggling to figure out what they were going to do at quarterback, right? Are you going to put out Wofford, or do you have Jared Goff, who's just coming off of thumb surgery, and put him out on the field? And Sean McVay clearly didn't want to do that. So you lost, and you lost at the point of attack, and you got beat in the run game. And Dave Wyman was not happy with that. And so when you needed that defense to come up big the most, they didn't. And that's just the truth. Now, was it the reason they lost the game? I don't think so. I think that the offense was the bigger piece of that. But the defense did share a role. So I think that this group, the defensively, has a chance to be a top 15 defense, a top 15 to top 10 type of defense. But it isn't going to be the defense that I believe that Pete Carroll can manage a game extremely conservatively because of that defense, like he did in the second half of the season, like he did those final five games of the year, because he really believed that that defense was playing, you know, top five level defense. And the reality was is that they weren't good enough to be able to play that style and play with that conservative nature at the end. That's why, Stacey, you were pounding the table so incredibly hard and making the point known about the Seahawks offense that they were only going to go as far as their offense would take him.
Well, and I do. We have about a minute left here. I want to focus on that point of being good enough for Carroll to play more conservatively. If your team can only go as far as your offense can carry you. Now, this isn't for every team. This isn't a rule that is steadfast and true at all times. I am talking for the Seattle Seahawks. Last year, throughout the season, it felt like your team will go as far as your offense can take you. And by the way, your offense is what's going to keep you from getting there too. That's the power that it has over your team right now. Your defense is not a top 1-2-3 defense that can take over a game and move you through the playoffs the way the Rams defense did for the Rams in that offense. And likewise, because your defense isn't a top defense, your offense can ruin a game for you and take you out of it. And they kind of did that, right, at the close of the season in that game against the Rams. They completely fell apart. They weren't able to score, and the Rams advanced. So does that need to change then the way that Carroll does things? Is it good? Is the defense going to be good enough? And that we have months to figure this out. Is the defense going to be good enough where we see it right now today for Carroll to play more conservatively, or are there other conversations that need to happen?
I I think that there's obviously other conversations that need to happen. That's why a big part of our conversation here in this town has been so hyper-focused on offense over the last couple of weeks. But I do believe that the Seahawks are in a very good position defensively moving forward and heading into 2021. I think that's what people should be really excited about, that you have something that is a known commodity. I don't believe it's going to be a top five commodity, but I think it's going to be a very good commodity. And now as you move forward, knowing that your defense should be more stable because of the way they finished, because of the fact that they were playing more together and they took on that next level of accountability, that same group is going to be back essentially, right? With a few changes and additions here or there, but relatively that same group is going to be back. The difference is I think that at the end of the season, you saw, particularly in that Rams game, that this isn't necessarily the defense that you could just hang your hat on for 60 minutes and let them go help you win the ball game and keep things close. And it's going to be a 10-9, knockout, dragout type of game. You still need this offense to perform at a high level. You still need this offense to go out and score points. And they did not do that in the second half of the season. That's what cost you your chance in the playoffs. That's what cost you a chance to go to the Super Bowl. I think your defense was in position to help you play complimentary, but it certainly was not going to be the main reason you got there. And I think that along the way, the Seahawks got themselves believing and thinking that that was going to be the case.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. He's Jake Heaps. I'm Stacey Ross. Producer Curtis Rogers is on the board. We've got Michael Bumpus joining us coming up later in the show. I want to ask him about DK Metcalf getting that new agent. What's that mean for future negotiations? We've also got a controversial tweet that I found the other day saying that Fernando Tatis's deal is bad for baseball. What the heck? Before we get to any of that, though, it is time for three questions. Brought to you by Tila Mortgage.
It's time for Three Questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 11:15, three burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
That's the dumbest question you could ask. What?
We've already seen three starting quarterbacks in the NFL get dealt this offseason, so who is the next one to get traded?
The next quarterback to get traded? I don't know.
I wrote down two choices.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think that Deshaun Watson is going to get traded until the very last second. I would have a very hard time believing that he is the next guy up. So, I don't know. I mean, Deshaun Watson ultimately at the end, I believe, is going to get traded. Mm-hmm. The Texans can sit there and play hardball as much as they want. I do not believe that Deshaun Watson is going to be playing for the Houston Texans this year. I believe he will forfeit all the losses necessary to prove his point that he will not play. So I think that as of right now, without knowing the next trade market, I think that Deshaun Watson definitely will be traded.
Now, I wrote Deshaun Watson. The second one I wrote was, what about Sam Darnold? And the only reason I think this isn't because the Jets are in need of draft capital. They have quite a bit of it. They've got a lot of nice cap space to get a lot done. But they're also going to be a new regime. This isn't the head coach, Robert Saleh, that fell in love with Sam Darnold as the quarterback. Anytime you get new guys in, they might want their guy. They might have a version of the team that they want. Does Sam Darnold fit into that picture? We don't quite know yet. So again, if the Jets were heading into the draft with four picks, I'd say, why wouldn't you trade Sam Darnold? Now, they aren't. They actually have quite a few picks, but I also don't know that he's their guy. So I wrote him as the second guy I think could get traded.
That's a good one. And if the market is reasonable for Sam Darnold, like let's say, you know, there was rumors that they were floating around, hey, well, we're willing to give up Sam Darnold for a second round pick. Okay. Yeah, I'd be pretty willing to do that too. I don't think you're going to get that. And I think that he would be more along the lines of a third round pick, maybe even a fourth round pick at this stage for Sam Darnold. So I don't know if they'll be able to get that type of compensation. That's just kind of a nice little rumor that the Jets flew out there. But he is definitely a trade candidate. No questions asked. I'm just not fully convinced that they're going to move on from him. So we'll see.
Number two.
Which position would you prefer the Seahawks add in free agency rather than in the draft?
I mean, the obvious one is offensive lineman. I think particularly at the left guard position, I would love to see them add a left guard in free agency. But But I, the other one that I would look at and like them to add in free agency would probably be at corner. I really would love to see them add a good veteran presence at corner. We've talked about Quentin Dunbar, what we think of him, and him probably being the guy, if they let Shaquille Griffin go, that they could add somebody like him. But I would love to see them be able to add somebody that has a little bit less injury history than Quentin Dunbar, if they could. That would be one that I'd be really happy to see, but I don't think that's going to be the case.
I said potentially wide receiver because I'd want to see you take a shot at a cheap free agent wide receiver since it's such a deep market, and maybe in the draft because it's also a somewhat deep wide receiver class. See if you can stock up on some cheap weapons. I also said running back in free agency specifically because of this. Do I know that running backs who are younger have less wear and tear on their bodies? Absolutely. But the number one problem the Seahawks running back room is going to have right now if they lose Carlos Dunlap and Chris Carson is inexperience. What do you need to bring into that room?
Carlos Hyde, you mean?
Carlos Hyde. Yeah. Yes, Carlos Hyde. What do you need to bring into that room? Experience. It may not be someone who's going to be your number one back. You're probably hoping that that's going to be Penny. But Penny has limited snaps and limited playing time because of his injury history. Missed most of last year. And you also have two guys that have played mostly special team stuff or as third running backs in DJ Dallas and Travis Homer. All three are going to be great parts of that running back room, but the part that you're missing is experience.
It's a good point. And the, also what you said in terms of the receiver market, you might have some very good quality receivers that their price tag is very inexpensive due to the fact that you've got another really, really good receiver draft class. Mm-hmm. So that could definitely factor in. I totally agree with you.
Number three.
One of the forgotten guys on the Seahawks roster, Marquise Blair. Is 2021 a make or break year for him?
Where's the role? I mean, that's the question that I have for Marquise Blair. I could see them trying to put him back at nickel corner because they feel like he is an upgrade over Ugo Amadi, and that's not a shot at Ugo Amadi. That just goes to speak of how much they value Marquise Blair's talent, what they think of him. That's the only place that I could see them try to implement him back into this thing is trying to get him and find him a role at that nickel corner spot again. But the question is going to be how well is he recovering from that ACL? I think Ugo Amadi played extremely well there at that position and will continue to keep growing. I'm a big fan of his. So ultimately, where do you put him? Does he become regulated to a dime package type of safety in passing situations? I don't know, but this guy's too talented. He's a second round pick. It is a make or break year for him, Curtis. No questions asked in my mind. And I just really hope that they can find a role because Marquise Blair, it's been frustrating with him over the last 3 years. This last year, nothing you could do about that with a torn ACL, with a freak accident. But this guy is so dang talented, and they haven't been able to get everything out of him to this point. I really hope in year three that they can find a role where he can be an impactful player. His talent is definitely there.
Now, it's make or break if you're looking for an extension, but I don't know about just a place on the team because I think that that packed safety room and safety group and defensive back group is exactly what's going to be able to buy him some time, that he doesn't need to be the starter right now. I also think, how many times have we seen the Seattle Seahawks give a ton of time to try to make their draft picks work out? I mean, Amara Darbo is someone they kept around as a third-round pick because they didn't want to part ways with him, and it caused a ton of controversy heading out of a training camp when they cut Kaysen Williams instead. So, I mean, I think that I don't know that this is a make-or-break year, but when it comes to an extension, Jake, you're right. He's certainly kind of cutting into some of that case. All right. Mariners Twitter. What's up, Mariners Twitter? Is fuming over an opinion that Mike Salk had. We'll tell you what it is next, and we'll ask him if he still backs it. Something tells me he will, Jake. That's next on Jake and Stacey.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
Joining us now is Mike Salk, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Mike, you need to stop getting into fights.
I do.
Getting into too many fights.
Who am I fighting with?
You know what? I guess I should reframe that. You're starting too many fights.
Oh, well, that's
You're not
different.
Necessarily a part of them, but...
I finish them, Stacey. I finish those fights.
Well, I don't know that you do.
Salk is the guy that starts it and then
walks
just...
away.
No, sprints away. Like, he's the instigator, and then when everything goes down, you just see Salk just really just
I'll tell you what
away.
You did, Mike.
You know what you mean.
You got Mariners Twitter real fired up after the signing of James Paxton, which became official with Seattle yesterday, by the way. And you said something about the Maple Grove. You want to tell us what that was?
I just think the Maple... I'm not a big fan of the whole Maple... Now, okay. I'm a fan of James Paxton.
Sure. Fan of Maples?
Fan of Maples in general. Maple syrup, even.
Canada.
Yes. I just yesterday rewatched the eagle landing on James Paxton, which I think is an underrated moment of hilarity. And how calm he is truly shocking that he is able to just stay calm.
Yeah,
because he doesn't
I
respect
do
the bald eagle.
I think he does. I think he's has so much respect for the bald eagle. He knows not to move. And like,
sure.
Hey, I'm just going to let this thing do its thing and hopefully it'll leave me alone like a Tyrannosaurus. But I think the Maple Grove's kind of pathetic. And I've said that since day one.
Didn't hold back.
Yeah. Wow. No, it's a pathetic attempt.
Why is it pathetic?
To try to recreate something natural and great, which is what the King's Court was. King's Court is amazing. It's truly one of the great bonding moments between an excellent top-tier player and a fan base that loved him, and he loved them back. I love it. I think it is, and it was great that the team latched onto it and made it bigger. The King, awesome. And truly about the love of a great player and a fan base back and forth. The bond with Felix and the fans was real and it was earned. This just feels like a hollow copy. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it was great. Remember how cool it was when we had, let's do a sequel. Well, are any of those original people going to do it? No. Now we're going to get some other people to be in this movie because we can't actually get the originals. They've moved on. So we're going to take a guy in James Paxton who's a good pitcher. Not great. Not Felix Hernandez in his prime.
You don't think he's deserving of a King's Court.
Fun he's not fact, deserving of his own thing. This okay. is why I keep saying, like, where does it end? Are we going to have Dylan Moore's dormitory? How little
Dylan
do you
Moore.
Have to do okay, before so, you get your own thing?
Okay, this is like my beef with the Mariners tweeting out, congratulating people for moving on and who haven't done anything here.
Right, like you've got to do on. Something. When James Paxton has the kind of career Felix Hernandez does, by all means, build him a grow.
Okay, I'm a problem
solver.
But not
like week one.
I'm a problem solver, and I believe that people are going to try and do this. That this is going to happen, whether you like it or not, Salk.
It's already
so
happened.
Can we come up with some suggestions that would help the Grove be better? Do they need to get into some maple tree
go to Canada.
Costumes? Or what can make this better?
Lifetime
that could be Salk approved.
It's like you need to do with really great players. When Jared Kelnick comes in, and if he has a couple of great seasons and he is going to be your superstar of the future, go crazy with this stuff. I love it. I am not anti-fun. I'm not anti-bonding. I just think you've got to save it for when it's real. Otherwise, it's embarrassing. And otherwise, it loses its specialness. If you're going to do this with everybody, just throw everybody in the Hall of Fame. What's the difference?
Yeah.
Just throw them on in. I mean, once we let Craig Biggio in, we might as well let everybody in. Just throw them all into the Hall of Fame, and then it doesn't mean anything. James Paxton shouldn't be in your version of the Hall of Fame. Felix Hernandez should. That's all. Let the guy do something first before you start honoring him.
You hear that, Maple Grove people? You hear that? Wait till James Paxton is doing something, and then we can talk.
There you go. Thank you. Okay. Couldn't have said it better.
There you go.
Yes. All right.
Tyron Walker. Just moving on. I'm just walking by it. Tyron Walker.
Are they going to get more mad? I hear Stick Riz is mad at me, and that honestly is...
Stick Riz?
Yeah.
Why?
Because of this whole thing.
What do you mean, because of the Maple Grove
There was
Grove
a
thing?
Huge thread about this. Yeah. The Maple Grove Twitter account, I didn't
Stick
know
Riz.
Existed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just like 11 tweets about how they're going to stick it to Saul.
The thing
no
is,
pun
did
intended.
They send you a strongly worded letter? Or?
Yeah. Well, the root cause of this whole thing, though, was that... Sorry. It was a tree joke.
Oh, the root
the
cause.
Root cause.
I'm moving on, Mike. Tyron Walker signs with the Mets. Fans were hoping he'd be with the Mariners. Are you disappointed?
A little bit, but by all accounts, I think they would have liked to have Tyron back if it was a one-year deal and he wanted a 2 or 3 year deal. The Mets were willing to give it to him, and so there you go. I think they just, you know, I like Tyron Walker a lot, by the way, and I think he really matured and grew up from the first time he was here to the second. My impression of Taiwan Walker is that he may be a guy that needs the carrot dangled in front of him, that he's going to be a little bit better in a contract year, that he needs that extra incentive to go work for it. And so I think the Mariners would have preferred to have him on a one-year deal. He ends up going to the Mets on a, what, two-year deal with a player option, so really a three-year deal from his perspective. You know, fine. I think sometimes you just got to tip your cap and say, okay, he ended up going somewhere else. I was hoping they wouldn't have traded him. I would have liked them to assign him last year, but some of what I've heard back is that maybe he's a guy who really can use that carrot dangled in front of him. So
gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, what about the conversation about Fernando Tatis Jr.? There's conversation about how, why would you pay somebody like him in a small market where he is not visible? Where,
do you want me to read the tweet?
Yeah, I do.
I saw that. Stacey, I saw you tweeting about
again.
That.
So
yeah.
For people that don't, this is the angriest I've been in a while. So Paul Hembekides, I'm sorry, Paul, if I'm saying your name wrong.
You're not sorry.
That's what I said, Hembekides. No offense, Paul. I'm sure you're a nice person. I just think your tweet is trash. He said, Fernando Tatis Jr. playing the next 14 years in the country's number 27 media market on the West Coast, God forbid, is an objectively bad thing for baseball. It's awful. Now, you are a staunch opponent to East Coast bias.
I mean, he's right.
Yeah.
He's right.
No, he's not.
Yeah, he is.
No, he's not. Mike.
He is right.
Why is he right that having, you have said before that you believe that baseball is an incredibly regional sport, most, more so than any other sport. Why do I, someone in Seattle, care whether or not Fernando Tatis plays for the Red Sox?
He didn't say that. He said for baseball.
For baseball? Isn't the health of baseball that more people care about baseball and more people watch baseball?
Yeah, but
or is it that more people watch Yankees games?
Yeah, I think, honestly, baseball's never been at its better height than in the early 2000s when people were only watching Red Sox and Yankees games, but the teams were that interesting.
Come on,
I'm not saying I prefer that, by the way. I am on your side on this, but I think he does have a point that to put your best players in places where they won't get seen as often is not necessarily great for baseball.
Yeah, but the question is, seen by who? Because this tweet makes the assumption that the people that are watching it, the people that matter, are going to be people in a New York market, people in a Boston market.
That's all
why
they
are
care
those,
about.
Why are those the people that matter the most?
I think because they're the only people that are going to watch no matter what. And that's
you're
his
telling me that Boston fans are watching Padres games no matter what?
No, I'm not. I think that's the point he's trying to make, which is like, hey, it's a multiplier. If you can put a player like that in one of the big media markets, they'll be seen more often. We saw it a few years ago. Kansas City goes to the World Series. Nobody's watching. Team was good. Team was exciting. But you're not able to generate the same kind of ratings you can when the big market teams, the Dodgers are obviously the biggest on the West Coast, but Dodgers and Giants, heritage teams, the same way people are talking about the NFC East all day. I don't like it, but I understand,
but
that these are the blue-blooded
the teams,
programs.
Because they're blue-blooded programs or because they've had stars?
I think it,
are people going to not watch Fernando Tatis because he's a Padre, or are they going to watch because he's a generational talent?
Fewer people will watch him because he's in San Diego than would watch him if he were in a big market.
What about people in California watching him? I mean, he is a guy that's on the cover of video games, Curtis.
Yeah, he's on MLB The Show 21.
You're telling me that that means that an 18-year-old that likes baseball isn't going to tune in to watch his game?
He might, but he'd be more but he would still have more people viewing it if he were in a bigger media market. Now, again, I'm psyched that he's insane. I don't like that model. I think baseball needs to start breaking away from that, and I think that there's a chance that you could try to grow the game up and make some changes to it, but I understand where your buddy is coming from with his trash take, because generally when stars are in the biggest markets, they're able to achieve greater success for the actual league itself.
I'm over it. I'm not.
Well, you better not be over it, because we're going to talk about it again.
Hembekides?
Yes. I don't know. I made that up.
Knockoff Greek god.
No.
We're going to be continuing this conversation because I am just like livid about it. We're going to be talking about it next. Maybe angrier than I've been in a while. And you know what? We have one enemy of the show right now. It's Troy Aikman. He doesn't know it, but he is an enemy of the show. Only one. I think we might need to add another.
Oh, Hembekides?
Hembekides.
And Stick Riz. Yes. Put them all together.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Ross.
This hour of Jake and Stacey is brought to you by Muckleshoot Casino. You ever have one of those days where you're just mad from the jump? Like, you wake up angry and things keep making you angry? for instance, I roll up to work. Jake comes in, daps Curtis. I do not get the cool high five thing. I did no love for Stacy. Fine. I'm rolling past it. Then I find out, no spoilers, because this is coming up in the timeline, Curtis, the Twitter account of a major sports organization follows Curtis. So I follow them and I just keep refreshing my page, hoping they're going to follow me. Nope. No love for me. Yes, these are both incredibly petty things. Don't get me wrong. But then, not only does that happen, but this happens. A content producer, and I really don't, this isn't like a personal thing. It's a fun opinion to have. Like, I appreciate the opinion because it gives me something to argue about. But I am so irrationally mad about it. I think it's specifically because the word West Coast is thrown in unnecessarily. From Paul Hembekides. I'm sorry, Paul. People say my last name wrong all the time. He is a content producer for Get Up on ESPN. He said, Fernando Tatis Jr. playing the next 14 years in the country's number 27 media market on the West Coast is an objectively bad thing for baseball. So, there you go, Padres. You ruined baseball. You killed it. You killed the sport. You killed the sport, Padres.
You did.
Not cheating scandals.
How dare you not let
not
this guy.
Not performance-enhancing drugs. Not any other scandal. It's you guys signing a major star in a small market. I mean, look, it. No one ever heard of Ken Griffey Jr. after he signed with the Mariners and was lost into oblivion.
Alex Rodriguez who? Randy Johnson who?
Exactly. Giannis who? Signing with what city in the middle of where? I don't know any of these people's major stars in small markets across the leagues. That's weird. I mean, who ever heard of Aaron Rodgers? Yes, the Packers are a historical franchise, so it's a little bit different. But point being, I see what Paul is saying here and what he's trying to say. Never mind the fact that there is a major top market on the West Coast. He's obviously talking, though, in this case about the San Diego Padres, which are a small market. But you know what I love about what the Padres are doing? That they're a small market that's taking the road that big markets have done. They're spending. They've got $812 million set aside on their infield alone. Just signed baseball's most promising young star to a 14-year mega deal that somehow is still underpaying him. And they're going about it in a way that feels fun. It feels exciting to watch them do things. And you know what? There are people that are not as avid baseball fans that are going to be interested to see what the Padres can do, because also everyone kind of loves an underdog. And when you're a small market team, you're an underdog. I hate the notion that paraphrasing kind of this sentiment, burying a star in a small market on the West Coast somehow ruins it for baseball. Baseball's a regional sport, Jake. We've talked about this a million times. There are plenty of fans in California and plenty of baseball fans around the world, including young, excited fans that are going to watch Fernando Tatis Jr. And maybe the problem that more people can't watch him is a problem with baseball and the way the MLB has their media rights, and not a problem with the San Diego Padres or the West Coast or the way that small market teams are trying to do this.
Well, I fully agree with what you're saying. 100%. And there are other examples, as you mentioned, Ken Griffey Jr., for example, in baseball. He was an extremely influential player at his time and still today over the game of baseball, and played in Seattle, which was considered a small media market, which was considered a dead franchise on arrival when before he turned that thing around with everybody else, a part of that fun, amazing run that they had with that core group of guys. Now, what I love, Fernando Tatis Jr., is an example that big markets can give an athlete a head start to the public eye, but it's certainly not a requirement. Major League Baseball, I would argue, is so completely starved for not just more superstar talent on the field, but superstar personalities. Mm-hmm. Think about that. Fernando Tatis, as you mentioned, he's on the cover of video games. He is being put on commercials. He is a guy who is nationwide is being recognized for his play, the way he goes about it. And if you just have a little bit of personality, a little bit of a cool bat flip, a little bit of swag, it can send you skyrocketing to the top as one of the more visible athletes in Major League Baseball. And that, to me, is an example of how bad Major League Baseball is growing and marketing their crop of guys. But I think I would
argue that this is actually better for baseball. I understand that the blue blood programs of the Red Sox and the Yankees and the Chicago Cubs and these other franchises, that you would be more visibly seen across baseball. However, you need baseball as a whole to be strengthened up. And to have the San Diego Padres be relevant, I think strengthens Major League Baseball. You know that people are going to be tuning in and watching the Red Sox and going to be watching the Yankees and watching some of these blue-blooded programs. But how about some of these other franchises, the Minnesota Twins, the Seattle Mariners one day, the Houston Astros at one point were a team that was nothing and turned themselves into something. There was great fanfare around what the Houston Astros were doing. So I think that overall, I understand the revenue that can be made when these blue-blooded programs are at their best. But in terms of visibility across the country, I think it's good. I think it's great for baseball that some of these other markets that aren't accustomed to being a part of the hunt, being a part of the landscape of the top of the food chain, are a part of it. It just makes it all the more fun to watch. The parity of the NFL is part of the reason why it is so fun to watch. And it's part of the reason why you pay attention to all 32 teams. Not all 32 teams every single given year, but you could be very tuned into the Tampa Bay Buccaneers one year and not be tuned into the next. But you are connected all across the country and are paying attention to what is happening across the landscape. In baseball, that doesn't happen.
Yep.
You are very regionalized, and maybe you see some of those blue-blooded games. You don't go and watch around the country and pay attention to it as much as you do with, for example, the NFL.
And parity is going to be different in the MLB because you just don't have the quick turnaround you can have. You can have a team go 9-7 one year or 7-9 one year and win a Super Bowl the next year like Tampa Bay did. You don't really get that in the MLB. But the biggest problem, I think, Curtis, you would echo this too, with the NBA for the longest time was there was no regular season parity. NBA playoffs, NBA finals were prime viewing. You didn't want to turn into half of the regular season games. And I think that that's been not the exact same issue with the MLB. Don't get me wrong, but part of the issue with MLB viewership, too, is that there were a lot of entire series that fans just wouldn't care about. And they'd be like, that team's trash. Why do I care what that team's doing? Now, do I think that Fernando Tatis solves some problem with parity as a whole in the MLB? No. Teams are always going to tank. Teams are always going to try to rebuild. I mean, that's never really been like a core value per se with the league. But I hate the idea, and this is me having my own West Coast bias, I hate the idea that the best stars should be reserved for premier teams on the East Coast, should be reserved for Boston, should be reserved for the New York Yankees, and that is what makes baseball healthier, not indeed just like good markets across the country.
Fernando Tatis is a game changer in Major League Baseball because, like you said, Stacey, he made regular season games matter last year. Remember the Padres-Rangers series a year ago where he flips his bat and hits a grand slam while they're up by like 9 runs or something?
Correct, yeah.
He had the country talking about a Padres-Rangers series, two teams that do not matter to a large portion of this country.
We talked about it.
We definitely talked about it. Everybody talked about it. And it was all because of this guy, because of how great he was and how he just kind of threw caution to the wind and was like, I'm swinging with the bases loaded. I don't care that we're up by 10 runs on this pathetic team. You know, this is somebody that makes games matter regardless of the uniform that he's wearing or regardless of the city that he's playing in.
Also, I like this text on the Vizzy Hard Seltzer text line. It reminds me, Curtis, of what you said in our show email with the three of us. They said, well, does the whole small market, big market argument or team even apply to younger generations? Think kids in their late teens, 20s. Because with free streaming sites, MLB The Show, video game, fantasy baseball, they know all the stars. So does it matter more that he isn't going to be where they can tune on and watch a game or where they know all the stars? Or does it matter more that he's on the cover of a video game or that he has a Twitter account or Instagram account that they all follow? You know what I mean? Like, maybe that is also good for the health of the game. Because one thing you struggled with for the longest time was, for instance, one of your biggest stars, Mike Trout, Wasn't that interesting? He wasn't drawing a ton of views. Fantastic baseball player, one of the best ever to do it, and will go down in history if his career ended today as one of the best ever to do it.
Correct. And no one pays attention to the Angels because of that, right? I mean,
yeah, because all he does is tweet out emojis when they're flying to a certain city. No offense, Mike Trout. You seem like a wonderful person. It's just not like
riveting.
But it's
true, though. I mean, to your point, as you were talking about the playoffs, there are some teams that you tune out for. The Padres traditionally would be one of those teams. They would be a plucky team that if they got to the playoffs, you know, hey, they don't really have any star talent, but they were able to get it done through the organization. The Oakland A's, for example. There's not a lot of people that are viewing the Oakland A's when they get into the playoffs. They recognize that they are a good franchise, a good organization that's getting to the playoffs because of the coaching, because of Billy Beane and the way that he's putting together his roster. But you now have people that are tuning into the Padres games, as Curtis, as you were mentioning, because they have a legitimate star that is worth watching, that is fun to watch. And I think that is good for baseball.
All right. DK Metcalf switched agents. So what does it mean for future negotiations with the Seahawks? We'll ask former wide receiver and current Seahawks pre- and post-game show host Michael Bumpus next on Jake and Stacey.